Well, I thought I'd bring something in the way of storytelling to you today. Sometimes when I travel, I like to tell stories that people haven't heard before, or hopefully haven't heard much before, although certainly many of the stories we have in the scriptures are something that we're all familiar with, but sometimes just telling them from a different perspective or a different person telling them becomes very interesting to people. At least I've found that, and I've taught that in some of our ministerial training classes. We talk about some of the things about that speakers should do that help audiences to pay attention and to enjoy what's being presented. And so that's one of the things that I talk about in the class that I give on the scriptures and bringing them to life, which is what I try to do. So I thought I'll bring one of those kinds of sermons for you today, if I could. And I'll just break it in half, basically, when we get to our, I understand you have a halfway break, break point. So I should probably be checking the time here to know when that break point is. I guess quarter two or something is when you break, I guess, for that second half. Let me begin with a short story. It's about a gentleman who was touring a cathedral in Europe. And it had been completed on the outside only. And once inside, the traveler found an artist who was kneeling before an enormous wall mosaic that he had been working on. And he was trying to create this mosaic, and it was very tedious work, you know, plastering in the individual little pieces of the things that they use to make them. And on some tables nearby were thousands of pieces of colored ceramic that he was sorting through and picking out the right one to put in the mosaics as he went along. And curious, the visitor asked the artist how he would ever finish such a large project because it covered such an enormous area of the wall. And the artist answered that he knew how much he could accomplish in one day. And if he was able to accomplish that much each day, each morning, he would mark off an area that he would complete or that he would plan on finishing that particular day as part of that space that he was working on. And that was the best that he felt he could do. And he said, eventually, I'll continue to do my best every day, and eventually, at some point, the mosaic will be done. It'll be finished. And we may look at a huge number of people that there are to reach in terms of preaching the gospel and reaching this world with the truth, and we wonder how it can be done. How is it going to happen? Well, obviously God can do enormous things with very few people. But God still calls one person at a time. He still begins to work with people one at a time. And 50% of that time, of course, it's in the fact that there's been a relationship with somebody else, that it's a one-on-one individual relationship that they have with other people. Because of their example, because of their life, because of the way they are, those people tend to influence others oftentimes in the world, and they wonder, well, how is it that that person is like that? Or how is it that they set such a good example? Or how is it that they are the way they are? And so they begin to ask questions about, well, you know, why, and I notice you go away every Saturday, or I notice you go away to the feast every year, or some other question along that line. And eventually they begin to work in a way, you might call it a miracle. Certainly God's calling of them is a miracle. And they begin to work a miracle of example that they set with those people. But in the meantime, you and I have to kind of continue to do what we do day after day, one step at a time, one day at a time. That's what we do. Let me read to you from the book of Romans here in chapter 15, if you want to turn over there. Romans 15 and verse 4. Romans chapter 15 and verse 4. Paul says, for whatever things were written before were written for our learning. And certainly the Old Testament is probably the inspired word of God that he's talking about, that we, through the patience and comfort of the Scriptures, might have hope. And indeed, the Scriptures do give us lessons, to help us to learn, to help us to understand God's way of life, and to help us to learn how to live. The Old Testament is full of stories. And those stories are lessons in what God would have us become, or what God would like us to be, or sometimes what God would not like us to be. Sometimes it can be a negative story, or someone did something that cost them a great deal of harm and difficulty because they sinned or did something that clearly was not according to God's way of life. But I love to tell stories, so I take the time to do that periodically and try to share them with people. So this morning what I'd like to do is examine the story of Gideon. Take a look at his life, and we'll see some lessons from it. Take a look at it today, and if you were looking for a title, you could call it The Sword of the Lord and of Gideon. The Sword of the Lord and of Gideon. There are many lessons, of course, in the story of Gideon. I'll try to point some of those out as we go along, because there are many of them, and as we progress through the story, sometimes there are things that we've seen, we've read, we understand, but maybe didn't fully comprehend what was going on in the story as we read it. Gideon, of course, lived over 3,000 years ago, long time. And we find him mentioned, of course, in the New Testament. He's mentioned in Hebrews 11, along with the faithful, those that are the heroes of faith that we find in Hebrews chapter 11. If you want to turn over there, it's actually verse 32, I think, where he's mentioned. Let's turn over there and at least read that verse while we're here. Chapter 11, verse 32. Hebrews 11 and verse 32. And what more shall I say? For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah, and also of David and Samuel and the prophets. There wasn't time at this particular point in time that Paul was speaking that he had the time to tell the stories of all of those individuals, although I imagine when he did speak, from time to time he dwelt on a number of those things. The Old Testament was the Bible of his day, and it was the scriptures, and he used it effectively, I'm certain. The story actually begins in the book of Judges. If you want to turn over there, Judges chapter 6 is where his story begins. Let's turn over to Judges chapter 6. Judges chapter 6. And actually verses 1 through 6. I'll just read the first 6 verses to get us kind of an introduction into his story. And the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord delivered them into the hand of Midian for 7 years. 7 years of service or slavery, so to speak, to the Midianite nations that dwelt around them. And the hand of Midian prevailed against Israel, and because of the Midianites, the children of Israel made them the dens which are in the mountains and the caves and the strongholds. They had to go into hiding in many ways to hide from the Midianites, who would take things from them when they came through the land, because they were now their servants. And so it was when Israel had sown, in other words, they put crops in the ground to live on, that the Midianites came up, and of course they came up at about harvest time to begin to collect their dues or the amount of service that they were supposed to have from them, from the Israelites. And the Amalekites and the children of the east, even they came up against them as well. In other words, they all kind of teamed up together against them to take from them what they felt was theirs now, that Israel was enslaved to them. And then camped again about them and destroyed the increase of the earth till you come unto Gaza and left no sustenance for Israel, neither sheep nor oxen nor ass. So there's a number of things in terms of the animals. They didn't leave any animals behind. They also took all the grain that they could take from the Israelites once it was harvested, and they left nothing behind for them to live on. For they came up with their cattle and their tents, and they came as grasshoppers for multitude, for both they and their camels were without number, and they entered into the land to destroy it. And Israel was greatly impoverished because of the Midianites, and the children of Israel cried unto the Lord. Finally turned again back to God, where they should have turned to in the first place, and began to seek God out. Now, it's interesting, the Midianites had what we might call, or has been called in the past, a scorched earth policy in regard to Israel, whom they hated and had envied for many years. Of course, verse 4 shows they tried to leave nothing alive for the Israelites to live off of after harvest time. And we've not yet, as a nation in this country, in Israel, suffered for our sins here as yet either. But there is a time of suffering coming. There is a time coming when God will bring retribution on Israel for their failure to obey him, or failure to accept him, or follow him, or do any of his will. And today in the United States, we see as a people, we are in the process of impoverishing ourselves in many ways, thanks to our rebellion, thanks to our sins as a nation, and as a people of modern Israel. We've done it to ourselves. The Midianites, you know, haven't been the cause of it, so to speak. You know, we haven't had other nations doing things to us as yet, although they certainly have tried in a number of ways. Other countries haven't even become involved that much in it yet. God hasn't stepped in and formally began to really do things. Maybe a few things that we look back in our past, 2001, and some of those events, maybe God has begun to reverse his protection on this nation and take some of those things away. But in the meantime, God has raised up a work to begin the process as one man, so to speak, to carry out his will. He began that work with Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong many years ago. We have tried to continue in his footsteps, tried to continue to serve God, tried to continue to follow God's way of life, and to do the things that we understand that we have as a commission, as a people to do. But because both yielded themselves, or both, Gideon and Mr. Armstrong, as I look at them both together in a way, or compare them together, both yielded themselves to God. They gave themselves over him to use as he chose to use, and he used them in a very powerful way. So we have kind of a comparison in some ways between them. In verse 11, he goes on and says, "There came an angel of the Lord and sat under an oak tree, which was in Ophrah, that pertained to Joash the Abrazite, and his son Gideon threshed wheat by the winepress to hide it from the Midianites." Which is a very logical thing to do when you think about it. You don't usually go to the wine press to do threshing of wheat. So the Midianites would have been probably waiting where people threshed wheat in order to take their portion of the wheat from the people that were threshing wheat at the time. So they went to the wine press to do their threshing, which was in a way to kind of camouflage themselves from the Midianites, who could arrive at any time and demand what they thought they had coming. Of course, the wine press was an unlikely place for anybody to be at that particular time of the year when you were threshing wheat. Verse 12, the angel here probably, I'll let you read ahead because I'm not going to read every single verse, because you can read a lot faster than I can. I can speak at maybe 300 words a minute. Most of you can probably read at least 600 words a minute or more, some 1,000, some 1,500, depending on what kind of speed reading you do. But you can usually stay well ahead of me. So anyway, we have this angel surprises Gideon, and especially with the comment, he says, the Lord be with you, you mighty man of valor. Now, if the Lord appeared to you and said that to you, mighty woman of valor, or whatever it happened to be, I think we'd all probably have a similar reaction to what Gideon does of surprise. Like, are you talking to me? Or was somebody standing behind me you were talking to? We'd have an equal reaction in that way. Gideon may have had he may have been very disturbed by what the angel said. Of course, he was disturbed probably by the angel appearing in the first place. But then by what he said as well. And he probably asked, well, are you talking to me, or was somebody else there? The Bible doesn't record every word of the conversation that the angel has with Gideon. And so we're not entirely certain of all that transpired here or all that was said with Gideon. Gideon is apparently perturbed that God hasn't done something for his people up until this point in time. You know, why are we all suffering with this plague of the Midianites, you know, at this point? Why has God not stepped in and done something for us and released us from this horrible abuse under which we're going? And he's a little upset about it, and he openly says so. And so the angel sees this in him, or sees his leadership potential here too. God does as well. And the Gideon says something needed to be done, basically. God, you need to do something. And it's interesting, the response here in verse 14. Okay, if you see this problem, now we'd like you to correct it. And Gideon is probably taken back a little bit. Or if you see all of this, you know, then you can be my instrument. You can do this for me, so to speak. And you can conquer the Midianites, and you can free Israel, and you can protect them, and you can do all of these things, or whatever was said, and you can change this scourge that's upon them. You can just kind of openly engage the enemy and deliver Israel. And Gideon is kind of taken aback. It's like, you must have me confused for someone else. I don't think I can handle it. He begins to backpedal very quickly here because he's afraid that God is serious and wants him to be the one who leads the army or does this process. In verse 15, he says, hey, you know, I'm from Israel's smallest tribe, and I'm the least in my family. This concept of being, I'm very, very small, and my people are very, very small. We can't do something like this. Have we ever said that as a church? That we're not big enough to do the mission that God has given us? I think we are. And we find that in this story almost, you know, repeatedly during the course of the story of how small or how little Gideon thinks he himself and his family and his tribe are, that they're unable to do what God is asking them to do. Do we as God's people, as a church, sometimes feel weak and unable to do all the things that God would have us do? And to succeed in the great work that he's called us to be a part of? I think we do sometimes. Sometimes we maybe lack a little faith in terms of what can be done. I know our church has tried for many years to preach the gospel, to reach people in as effective a way as we can. Just because God isn't calling hordes and hordes of people all at once does not mean we aren't doing what he's asking us to do. I think he will call more when the time is right, when he decides that it's appropriate and it's proper, and he'll do it. But we, in the meantime, have to just live day after day doing what God asks us to do, and to function as Christians and to walk in the way he would have us walk. Our new donors, our co-workers are increasing. You know, there's many things that are increasing in terms of the internet. There are lots of growth in those areas. Eventually, he will probably call more and more people too. But for the moment, it does not seem like he's willing to do something grand and glorious at the moment. Then again, he wasn't willing to do something grand and glorious with Gideon in the opening or in the beginning, but eventually he did. Then the angel in verse 16 makes a very interesting comment. He says, this as one man, that phrase that you see, as one man in verse 16, the Lord said unto him, surely I will be with you, and you shall smite the Midianites as one man. Now this was probably a Hebrew idiom, at the time, that meant basically that if you conquered the Midianites, they would fall as one man would. In other words, it'd be like fighting one man. He'd fall over, that's it, the rest of them are done. And the expression was, it's not any worse than fighting one person, I guess is another way to put it. When God's with you, he'll take care of the rest. It'll be like fighting just one person. And this apparently reassures Gideon. And he decides, well, okay. Gideon, of course, asks the angel for, well, can you kind of give me a sign here? Perhaps Gideon was afraid he might be dreaming all of this, or that he was having a vision and maybe wasn't really, maybe he was hungry and he was working out in the heat maybe and was a little afraid maybe I'm seeing things or hearing things that aren't really happening. So he asks for a sign. And Gideon, of course, prepares a kid of the goats and unleavened cakes. It's an interesting part of the story here, too. Unleavened cakes is mentioned here exactly three times. Three times. Was it because there was no leavening to be found anywhere, or you certainly wouldn't offer leavening in the things that you would offer on the altar? Unleavened bread was typically what was offered when you offered grain or the baked cakes. They would be unleavened when you offered them to God. So it could be that, but it also could be the fact that this time of the year may have been during the days of unleavened bread, or right around Passover, days of unleavened bread. The Bible doesn't say specifically, can't know for sure, but it probably was, it certainly was the spring feast time with the threshing time going on, so it's very likely that's part of it. Winter wheat would be coming in, and of course Gideon was a wheat farmer as well. And this unleavened cakes may actually be symbolic of the first wave sheaf, if we think about it. And Gideon maybe was a type of the wave sheaf. People often, in fact, peoples are often released from bondage on Passover. And certainly in the fall as well. On the Day of Atonement, sometimes the Day of Atonement and Passover Day seem to be a time in which God historically has provided release for individuals. Certainly has for my family on occasion too. And it was, I suspect, the days of unleavened bread. We shouldn't expect to find some, or we should expect to find some symbolism in the story if it was the days of unleavened bread. And we do find some symbolism in the story of the days of unleavened bread too. In fact, if you notice verses 25 through 27, I'll read them to you here. And it came to pass the same night that the Lord said unto him, take your father's young bullock, even the second bullock of 7 years old, and throw down the altar of Baal that your father hath, that your father has, and cut down the grove that is by it. And build an altar unto the Lord your God upon the top of this rock in the ordered place, and take the second bullock and offer a burnt sacrifice with the wood of the grove which you have cut down. Then Gideon took 10 men of his servants and did as the Lord had said unto him, and so it was, because he also feared his father's household. Now why is he fearing his father's household? I'll answer that in a minute. And the men of the city, that he could not do it by day, that he did it by night. What does this have to do with the days of unleavened bread? And what is it, you know, why is he doing this by night, and what's going on here? Well, it's probably during the days of unleavened bread. What are those days symbolic of? Well, walking a new life, removing sin. What's he doing? He's cutting down this grove of idolatry that is here. He's cutting down all the wooden poles, and he's destroying the altar to Baal. So basically, what is Gideon doing? He is preparing for Passover in the days of unleavened bread, if you want to look at it that way. He's walking a new life, and that is exactly what Gideon is engaged in here. That's what we engage in before the Passover in the days of unleavened bread too. Putting sin out from our family first. And it's interesting too that this grove probably was his father's grove. That's one reason he's doing it at night. His father's family wouldn't have been too happy about him doing this either. Gideon came from probably a family of idol worshippers. People who weren't following God. And this is his father's grove that he's probably destroying. And God is often in the habit of using the lowest to the lowly, if you want to put it that way, of the tribes of the lowest family, of people who are often deceived to serve him. It's interesting how God calls us out of the miserable lives sometimes we were leading before he came along and began to call us into his family and to begin to work with us. And Gideon is among the lowest and of the smallest tribes and of the smallest people. And his father is probably the guy who runs the Baal center, so to speak, in the neighborhood here for all of the people of the city too. It's interesting. God's in the habit of calling people who are deceived and helping them to see themselves and to change. And Gideon was going through that process, and we see just so with him. Christ made a disciple out of the apostle Matthew Levi. Why? Well, Matthew Levi was a tax collector, probably considered to be among the lowest of scum of the society of the day. The Jews hated them. The Romans used them, but didn't care much for them. They were not considered very popular people. And God does that. We're not all the greatest and the best when God calls us either. Yet God will do mighty things with Gideon. Well, because Gideon was willing to change. Gideon was a little afraid, but he was willing to change. Gideon, an idolater, is the one God uses to purge Israel of what? Idolatry. Interesting how God will do that. How ironic it is that God will do something like that. Gideon proceeds to pull down his family's altar to Baal. And it's interesting here how in the morning after, in verse 28, all of the men of the city notice that, of course, the grove, the altar's been destroyed and the grove has been cut down. And now if this, of course, is their family altar and grove, why would all the men of the city notice it the next morning unless it was also their altar? Which I think it probably was. Perhaps Gideon's dad was the local caretaker of the grove and the altar here, or even one of the priests. We don't know. But Gideon's family was certainly entrenched in idolatry or was involved in it before God called him. An angry mob, of course, now confronts Gideon and his father, Joash the Abrazite, and the next morning they're confronted with this crowd. So, but he has some sway with the mob, apparently. Maybe because he was a priest, maybe because he ran the center for Baal here, so to speak, however you want to call it. And he, of course, accepts their pleading for their god, Baal. And he inquires of them, doesn't that make your god pretty helpless? Don't you think Baal could do something about this if it was really up to him and he really wanted to do something about this? And so he asks the mob, and of course, apparently the mob calms down because he either is the administrator of the site here or he's a priest or whatever it happens to be, and they calm down a little bit. And apparently Gideon is spared because they were going to string him up. Gideon is even known or becomes known at this point as Jerub Baal, which I think in Hebrew means let Baal contend, or in other words, let Baal contend for himself. He can defend himself. Let him do it. So basically that's what happens here. And Gideon calls, he goes about through all of Manasseh. Of course, we know Manasseh is probably the United States today. And to these other tribes, Asher and Zebulun and Naphtali, and he goes seeking out individuals. And they come to speak with him about their common predicament, which is the Midianites. And they all want to be rid of the Midianites. So, and for once, they're all pretty much united about this particular issue. But again, Gideon wants to be sure that God is inspiring what it is that he's doing. He doesn't want to just act on his own. He doesn't want to just do it himself. In a way, he wants to know that God is immediately involved in the fight or immediately involved in what's happening. So he asks God to perform a second sign. And the fleece that he leaves on the floor overnight. Now, sometimes we think, well, God's not very much into doing signs like this. Well, usually he isn't. But in the case of Gideon here, he does. He seems to honor Gideon's faith that has maybe been drained somewhat by the experience with the mob, by the experiences that he's had with the Midianites. He's maybe not looking at himself as a very strong individual. And so he came close to losing his life here just recently with the mob after destroying the image to Baal, or the Baal's altar. And so we can see his confidence needs a little lifting. Maybe that's why God accepts this request and responds rather than saying, don't ask me for a sign. He responds by encouraging him rather than faulting him for his faith. If you look at verses 26 through 40, which I'm going to take a look at here in a minute, right after a break. We're going to take a break and then we'll come back. Let's see, we were going to read Judges chapter 6. Closed my Bible and lost my place here. Let's see, Judges chapter 6, I believe verse 26 is what I was going to read. Now, verses 26 through 40, it's a good section to read. He says, And build an altar unto the Lord thy God upon the top of this rock in the ordered place, and take the second bullock, and offer a burnt sacrifice with the wood of the grove which you have cut down. Now, of course, groves back then often were sometimes wooden poles, often like what we might think of as a totem pole, or these were poles offered to various gods. And he'd cut those all down so he had plenty of wood to burn for the sacrifice. Then Gideon took 10 men of his servants and did as the Lord had said unto him, and so it was, because he feared his father's household and the men of the city, that he could not do it by day, but that he did it by night. I think I may have backed up here further than I wanted to. Maybe it's chapter 7 now. Not chapter 7. Well, I'll let you guys read some of this, and then I'll skip down here to what we've already read. Okay? Okay. Let's go down to I read through 27, I think, last time. 28, and then the men of the city arose early in the morning. Behold, the altar of Baal was cast down, and a grove was cut down that was by it, and the second bullock was offered upon the altar that was built. And they said one to another, who's done this thing? And when they inquired and asked, they said, Gideon, the son of Joash, has done this thing. And then the men of the city said to Joash, bring out your son, that he may die, because he has cast down the altar of Baal, and because he hath cut down the grove that was by it. And Joash said unto those that stood by, that stood against him, will you plead for Baal? Will he save him, or will you save him? He that that will plead for him, let him be put to death whilst he is yet mourning. I'm sorry, I'm having a little trouble reading here. I need to pull this Bible over a little closer where I can look at it. And he be a god, let him plead for himself, because he hath cast down his altar. Therefore, on that day he shall be called Jerubbaal, which I mentioned earlier, and what that means in Hebrew. And then all the Midianites and the Amalekites and the children of the east were gathered together and went over and pitched in the valley of Jezreel. But the Spirit of the Lord came upon Gideon. Now he begins to react to what God is doing through him. And God's Spirit apparently comes upon Gideon. He begins to understand a little bit more about what he needs to do. God has strengthened his faith a little bit. And he blew a trumpet, and Abiezer was gathered after him. In other words, individuals began to follow him. And he sent messengers throughout all Manasseh, who were also gathered after him. And he sent messengers to Asher and to Zebulun, to Naphtali, and they came to meet with him. And they figured, well, Gideon's kind of shown himself as a leader in Israel, so let's go up and see what he'll do for us. Maybe he'll help us overthrow the Midianites, or maybe he'll take the lead and do something for us. And of course, in verse 36, Gideon said unto God, if you will save Israel by my hand, as you have said, behold, I put a fleece of wool on the floor, and if the dew be on the fleece only, and if it be dry upon the rest of the earth outside or beside, then shall I know that you will give Israel my my hand as you have, or give, save Israel by my hand as you have said. And it was so, for he rose up early in the morning and on the morrow and thrust the fleece together and wring the dew out of the fleece, a bowl full of water. And Gideon said unto God, let not your anger be hot against me, but I will speak but this once. Let me prove I may, I pray thee, but this once with the fleece. Let it now be dry upon the fleece and upon all of the ground. Let there be dew. And God did so that night, for it was dry upon the fleece only, and there was dew upon all the ground. So basically that gives you the idea, the thread of the story of what happened in terms of the initial miracles. And we find Gideon twice tests God here, and three miracles are now shown to Gideon before it's time for Gideon to get on with, or as what we would say, get on with the work that God has in mind for him to do. You know, which is an interesting analogy if we compare it today to ourselves a little bit and ask, okay, how much do we test God before we do what he asks us to do? Sometimes we do that as human beings. Sometimes we don't always want to do exactly what it is God would like for us to do. Sometimes we don't want to fully do all that he has asked us to do or what we know he would have us be doing. Sometimes we're not quite willing to do that. And it's interesting that Gideon is put through exactly the same process here too, to find out if he's willing to do what God has asked him to do. And we think about that for a moment in the overall sense of the church and the overall sense of individuals in the church. Perhaps we can consider God's work today, the preaching of the gospel that needs to be done as well. How willing are we to do it? Have we had the signs necessary that we need to believe that it can be done? God has blessed our efforts, continues to bless our efforts, though we may fail somewhat in dealing with divisions among us that happen. Certainly God has asked us to do a job. We don't want to be a part of causing those divisions, if we can certainly help it. Perhaps we've seen that a church can be formed up of confusion, anger, jealousy, all kinds of things can cause those things to happen. That indeed, smaller groups of people can begin to do a work too. God can work through small people, small groups of people. That we have been able to sprinkle a lot of the seed of the gospel message around this world on very fertile ground, or what could be very fertile ground. Perhaps it's time for us to begin to gather a harvest again. Maybe we just need to have the faith to expect God will do it. Our internet sites are becoming quite successful. Lots of areas of the work are growing. 80% of people now, before they come to church, regardless of whose church it is, they check your church on the internet. They want to see what the internet says about your church and your people. And what they see there in pictures or writing, that's what they know they're going to find when they go there. 80%. I didn't realize it was that high, but apparently it is. People check the internet to see before they go to church, anywhere. Gideon's method of putting out a fleece here in order to test God isn't the best method of obtaining God's guidance in a situation. Spiritually, I think we can see that it isn't the best thing. But perhaps for a man who's weak, as Gideon is here, God tolerated it. He accepted that weakness and that weakness in faith at the moment. But he does expect us to grow, and he does expect us to increase in faith. So, brethren, today, if you have any faith at all, don't ask God to rain on your fleece, so to speak, at the moment. We all should be a little bit past the needing of those kinds of signs. But perhaps for someone as weak as Gideon, it was needed at the moment. People who live by sight rather than by faith often have to have more and more signs repeated over and over and again to them, because their faith is weak, and they rationalize the signs away as coincidence or as something that just happenstance, and consequently they have more or less they want to have them repeated over and over again, or they want to have more and more signs. Had Gideon simply obeyed God without question here, perhaps the blessings, some of the blessings would have, you know, from Abraham would have flowed through Gideon. I don't know. Might be interesting. Just kidding. I don't know that that's necessarily the case, but maybe if Gideon had shown a little more faith here, it might have, things might have gone a little differently too for him. Gideon might have become known as the father of the faithful, if we want to put it that way in some ways. But this was an area for weakness for Gideon. He, you know, we don't want to follow the example of his weakness. We want to follow his example of cooperating with God, of doing what God asked him to do. Again, we're going to see that Gideon makes another big mistake here before long, and we see Gideon by these signs mistakenly sees God's stamp of approval on the numbers that he has in his army, which amounted to some 32,000 men. I think you see the numbers come up here in a few verses. And God's promise of victory nowhere says, only if you have a large army will I protect you and will I give you the victory. It just doesn't say that, does it? Nor does God say that the church before the time of the end will accomplish his will because we have a large group, or we have a big group, or we have a large bunch of people. He doesn't say that either. The question is how faithful are the people that we do have? That's where the big question comes. We have to keep that lesson in mind. God can do very much with very little. And that's part of the lesson of Gideon's whole story when he's ready to do so. Now, Gideon, of course, has gathered this army of 32,000 men. He feels quite confident that I've got enough guys. I can do this. And he's beginning to develop confidence, maybe not so much in God, but more in the numbers that he's got, that we've got enough, we can do something here. Maybe he's beginning to rely on the numbers a little too much. So God decides, well, let's do a little adjustment here. And so we see God now steps in to impose another test on Gideon to find out what he's thinking. And Gideon offers God tests. What does God do in return? God offers Gideon tests, too. He begins to test Gideon. You ever wonder why it isn't wise to roll out your fleece and ask God to do something for you when you lack faith? Because God is likely to then come down and to test you in return. Sometimes that happens. I think I'd prefer to have God not test me. What about you? I think most of us would prefer it that way. But notice how gently and indirectly God does test Gideon here in chapter 7. Let's read the first couple of verses in chapter 7. Then Jerubbaal, who is Gideon, and all the people that were with him rose up early and pitched beside the well of Herod, so that the host of the Midianites were on the north side of them by the hill of Morah in the valley. And the Lord said to Gideon, the people that are with you are too many for me to give the Midianites into your hands, lest Israel vaunt themselves against me, saying, mine own hand has saved me. In other words, this number that we had is what did the trick for us rather than God. Now therefore go to proclaim in the ears of the people, saying, whosoever is fearful and afraid, let him return and depart early from Mount Gilead. And there returned of the people 22,000 people, and there remained 10,000. So now he's down to 10,000 people that are left after the fact. And God doesn't say to Gideon that he personally is trusting in his great army, but that Israel might also think that this army that Gideon has put together was what resulted in the victory over the Midianites. God doesn't want that to happen. He wants to increase their faith, but he also wants them to realize that it's him doing it, not the numbers that they have or what they show in numbers. And we see 22,000 people disappear on the over the horizon. And you can imagine Gideon, what he's himself thinking at this point. Maybe he's beginning to think, oh no, two-thirds of my membership has left. Now what do I do? Gideon's left with 10,000 men. Will he be able to do a great work? Interesting to see this. Gideon is now left with this little number. And maybe he's thinking to himself, I can't do this with 10,000 people. The Midianite army, of course, numbered around 135,000, as we see in Judges 8, verse 10. And so the odds are now 135-1, basically, that he's dealing with. And God isn't through testing Gideon either. There's more yet to come. Verses 4 through 7, he goes on, and the Lord said to Gideon, the people are yet too many. Bring them down to the water, and I will try them for you there. And it shall be that of whom I say unto you, this shall go with you, and the same shall go with you, and of whomsoever I shall say unto you, this shall not go with you, the other shall not go. And so he brought down the people unto the water, and the Lord said unto Gideon, everyone that lappeth of the water with his tongue, as a dog laps, him shall you set by himself, and likewise everyone that bows down upon his knees to drink. And the number of them that lapped, putting their hand to their mouth, were 300 men. But all the rest of the people bowed down upon their knees to drink water. In other words, they got down on their hands and knees to drink from the water. There's a lot of theories about why that's the case. I'll express those in a minute. Verse 7, and the Lord said to Gideon, by the 300 men that lapped will I save you and deliver the Midianites into your hand, and let all the other people go, every man to his place. Send the rest of them home. And so we see 9,700 men are drinking lapping like a dog, bent over the water, and 300 men kind of squatted down and lapped with their hand out of the water. And these God said would save Gideon. And there are various theories about why that's true, or why they lapped, or why they bent over, or why God picked the ones who lapped. There's lots of questions about that. Perhaps because squatting, they could stand up quickly and defend themselves if they were attacked, and they were more prepared for being attacked. There's lots of theories about why that's the case. But God was going to do the miracle anyway. It wasn't, I'm sure, based on what the individual talents of those particular men. The 300 men, of course, that were left, we have to wonder what Gideon is thinking. He's down to 300 from 32,000. And he's against 135,000. And that's apparently just the Midianites, too. There may have been other nations who took advantage of Midian ruling Israel to invade the land periodically under their auspices and take things from the Israelites, too, and go home. But apparently only the Midianites actually came up to fight a little bit later. And, of course, all through this time, God's dealing with Gideon. Gideon has been growing spiritually, I hope. He's got God's Holy Spirit at this point. And he's beginning to do things maybe a little more along the lines of the way God would expect him to do them. Physical strength here is not an objective. He's still a little weak in the faith, maybe. But spiritual strength is not what God is, spiritual strength is what God's after. He's not after so much the physical strength. That's what he's looking for. In 2 Corinthians, keep your finger here. We'll go over to 2 Corinthians for a moment, chapter 12. Let's see. 2 Corinthians chapter 12. Paul makes an interesting statement. 2 Corinthians chapter 12. And let's see, verses 9 and 10 of 2 Corinthians chapter 12. And he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you. God speaking to Paul here. For my strength is made perfect in weakness, or we might say in smallness as well. Most gladly, therefore, will I rather glory in my infirmities, that the power of God may, or the power of Christ may rest upon me. Therefore, I take pleasure in infirmities, in reproaches, in necessities, in persecutions, in distresses for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then I am strong. It's interesting that this God is concerned about this spiritual strength of Paul. Paul was feeling the strength when he was weak, that God worked through him more effectively when he was weak. The same is true for us today. The physical strength of the church may be small. Sure, it is. But the question is how much spiritual strength do we have that God has given to us? God can use a very weak physical instrument like Gideon or the Apostle Paul when he helps strengthen them spiritually. And he can do that for each and every one of us. Israel had become by this time a divided, quarreling, bickering group of people, and they were incapable of being led by someone who was apparently physically as weak as Gideon. They would have laughed at him until God performed the miracle that he did and the miracles that began to happen. Then the people began to realize, well, you know, God is working through Gideon. Wow, maybe we should better get in line here. And then they came out and joined Gideon's victory over the Midianites a little bit later. Let's continue the story now. Gideon needs a little reassuring here in verses 9 through 15 of chapter 7. And it came to pass in the same night that the Lord said unto him, Arise, get you down from the host, for I have delivered it into your hand. But if you fear to go down, go with you, go thou with Purah, thy servant, down to the host. And you shall hear what they have to say. And afterwards shall your hands be strengthened to go down into the host. And when he went down with Purah, his servant, into the outside of the armed men that were in the post or in the host, and the Midianites and the Amalekites and all of the children of the east lay along in the valley like grasshoppers for multitude, and their camels were without number as the sand by the sea for multitude. And when Gideon was come, behold, there was a man who told a dream unto his fellow and said, Behold, I dreamed a dream, and lo, a cake of barley. Bread tumbled into the host of the Midian and came unto a tent and smote it, that it fell and overturned, and the tent lay along. And his fellows answered and said to him, This is nothing else save the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, the man of Israel, for unto his hand hath God delivered Midian and all the host. Interesting story. And it was so when Gideon heard the telling of the dream and the interpretation thereof, that he worshipped and returned to the host of Israel and said, Arise, for the Lord has delivered into your hand the host of Midian. Now he's confident once again. Of course, God has to test him a little bit and give him a sign to kind of help him to see what he needs to do. And of course, we then read the rest of the story here, and they sound the alarm and they charge into the camp. And then we see Gideon dividing his 300 men into three groups. And each of them were equipped with leftover trumpets and who knows what else, pitchers and clay pots of some kind, in other words, things to make noise with. And Gideon instructed them, When I blow the trumpet, and all who are with me, when you also blow the trumpets on every side of the whole camp and shout the sword of the Lord and of Gideon. Then they held their torches high to be seen, letting their light shine. A little symbolic of today. Maybe we need to hold our torches high and we need to let our light shine a little more as well. The story has so many parallels with us today, it's not even funny. I don't even have time to point them all out. But it's interesting now that they hold up the lights to shine, they shout, they blew the trumpets, and the enemy would think there were thousands of them in the darkness. And sure enough, panic and confusion reigned in the Midianite camp. And in the darkness, the men fought with each other, and they fled. And then messengers were sent to the other tribes of Israel, and others came to continue the rout of the Midianites. In verse 25, last verse, And they took two princes of the Midianites, Oreb and Zeb, and they slew Oreb upon the rock. Oreb and Zeb they slew at the winepress of Zeb, and pursued Midian, and brought the heads of Oreb and Zeb to Gideon on the other side of the Jordan. So they had great success. The leaders of the Midianites were captured and killed by the Israelites. And now notice chapter 8 of Judges, that the men of Ephraim were now mad, of course, because they hadn't gotten to be part of the battle. Gideon hadn't gone to Ephraim to ask for their help in this process. You just can't please them all sometimes, can you? No matter what you do. And at this point, we might ask, well, about other churches of God? What about other churches of God, other groups that can help or could be part of what we're doing? They could be part of the preaching of the gospel. Fine, let them do it. I only hope they don't become jealous of what we do, as the Ephraimites did, and cause trouble for the rest of Manasseh. That wasn't a good thing. The Ephraimites also captured two of the Midianite kings as well. The battle is not over. There are still two kings, Zeba and Zalmunna. So they have to be rounded up as well. An army of another, I guess, 15,000 that Gideon had gathered, and his 300 are now pursuing them. And they stopped to seek food and water from the men of Succoth and Penuel. But of course, these men refused to supply it to them. So Gideon tells them,
I'll be back.
And he continues his pursuit of Zeba and Zalmunna, the Midianite kings. And he caught them and their host and slew all of the host of the 15,000. And then he returned and the two kings of Succoth and taught them a lesson and tore down the tower of Benuel and slew the men of the city. And then he slew the two kings, Zeba and Zalmunna. And what we see here is a progression of Gideon and his faith. He's strengthened. And suddenly after the battle is underway, we see Gideon growing in many ways. And he asks God for a sign. He says, shall I pursue Zeba and Zalmunna and their 15,000 men? After all, they outnumbered is 50-1. No, Gideon simply pursues them and slaughters them. It doesn't seem to stretch Gideon's faith to be able to do it now. He seems to have a lot of confidence in what God is doing through him. Even his treatment of the men of Ephraim is humble, but he doesn't seem to fear. He seems to know he's pleasing God, and these men certainly aren't going to impede that process either. And when we find an interesting conclusion here, too, to what he does in chapter 8, verses 22 and 23. I'll skip over there. Obviously, don't have time to read all of the story. It's a fascinating story. You can go through and read all the verses yourself sometime. But verse 22, he says, then the men of Israel said to Gideon, rule thou over us, both thou and thy son's son also, for you have delivered us from the hand of Midian. And Gideon was at least wise enough to say what he says. And Gideon said unto them, I will not rule over you, neither shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you. Wow. Gideon's come a long way. The temptation here for others probably would have been to say humbly, except, well, certainly I'll be your king. But he doesn't do that. Gideon has certainly learned a lot as we see him progress. Verses 24 to 27 now. Let me read those as well. And Gideon said unto them, I would desire a request of you that you should give me every man the earrings of his prey. For they had golden earrings because they were Ishmaelites. Many of them apparently wore gold earrings of some kind. And they answered, we will willingly give them. And they spread a garment and did cast every man in his earrings of his prey. And the weight of the gold earrings that he requested was 1,700 shekels of gold, besides ornaments and collars and purple raiment that was on the kings of the Midianites, and besides the chains that were about their camels' necks, and on it goes. And Gideon made an ephod thereof and put it in his city, even in Ophrah. And all Israel went thither whoring after it, which thing became a snare unto Gideon and to his house. It's interesting that seems like he's going back to doing what he was before, what he did before, sadly. Gideon was wise enough to refuse the kingship, but not wise enough to simply walk away. He decided that he ought to reward, or his efforts ought to be rewarded in some way, and his success. I hope none of us seek reward or for our efforts in serving God. Again, it seems Gideon returned to a way of life, earning a way of living that was similar to what his family had always done. The ephod, I'm not exactly sure how that worked or what it was, but like father, like son in some ways, a little bit of a character fault for Gideon. Gideon could have destroyed the ephod when people first started worshiping it, but apparently he did not. Apparently he didn't, and it became a snare to him and his house and Israel later. Perhaps like the altar to Baal in the grove had been to his father before him. Verse 33. Kind of And it came to pass, as soon as Gideon was dead, that the people of Israel turned again and went whoring after Balaam, and became and made Baal Berith their god. And it seems Gideon, of course, in some way, was preventing Israel from returning to idolatry outright, at least while he was alive. We don't know exactly how or what, but they did return to the worship of Baal almost immediately after his death. And there was 40 years of peace in Israel during the remainder of his life. Today we have a society founded on his name, the Gideons. Of course, they place Bible society, they put Bibles in motels and hotel rooms all over America. I think they still do that. Fine example of spreading the word of God, spreading God's way of life, I guess, in a way, by putting those Bibles there for people to read. Small group, they've had a very powerful impact on this country in many ways. At least they did for a number of years until people actually quit reading the Bible. I don't think very many people read those Bibles that are all out there now. I hope we can make an even more profound impact for an even smaller group that we are. As a small group, by encouraging people maybe to actually sit down and read those Bibles. If we come to know people and explain to them why we do what we do and the example that we give, and how we live, that they'll have the desire to want to do likewise. The story of Gideon is indeed an inspiring one in many ways, with many lessons for us today, and I hope that we as individuals and as a church will seek to finish the will of God and the commission that he's given to us. It's important for us to be involved in what God is doing, to share that commission with one another, and it is important for us to be involved in all that God is taking part in this society today and in this world today. God's strengthening our faith along the way, just as he has done to Gideon, just as he did to Mr. Armstrong, just as he has done to his church all along. And we need to preach the gospel of the kingdom of God and make the disciples and care for those disciples. That's all part of the lesson of Gideon. It's all part of the lesson for us today to do as well.